This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, we'll look at local water issues and possible solutions.
Things that we work on in California really can apply anywhere else in the arid West, anywhere else in the country or the world. Everywhere we need water, and we need water that's sustainable.
Also, the tall poppy syndrome and why we cut others down.
The metaphor is to look at a poppy field and seeing a few poppies taller than the rest, and the natural tendency to cut that person or those tall poppies down so that everybody's equal.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, May 6th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with a look at a workshop on recycling textiles. Dave Cross from Santa Maria Valley Chamber of Commerce coordinated the workshop. He works closely with Cal Recycle to find new ways for local businesses to reduce waste. Beth Thornton has more.
Dave Cross is with the Santa Maria Valley Chamber of Commerce and serves as the regional manager for the Recycling Market Development Zone, a program through Cal Recycle. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start having you explain what a recycling market development zone is and what your role is as the regional manager.
I appreciate that. The RMDZ, which is the Recycling Market Development Zone, is a program through Cal Recycle. There's 28 of them throughout California. The ones that we administer as zone administrator is Santa Barbara County. It's called the Santa Barbara Regional RMDZ Zone. And what we do is we focus on businesses and industry. We try to bring new markets for recycling. We promote businesses that bring recycled content into their businesses to produce more of their product and turn around, try to create a recycle circular economy where recycled materials continually come into industry and manufacturing. So there's a lot of things that we do to try to help businesses and promote awareness for recycling.
Cal Recycle is a state program that funds these efforts on a more regional level, right?
Yes. And Cal Recycle, and I urge everyone to go to the calrecycle.ca.gov website. It's a very good website. It highlights the efforts that the state is doing for recycling. It highlights the program like RMDZ and also shows you how you can participate and be involved.
The circular economy, which you just referenced, and I know that's all over the website for Cal Recycle. And the idea there is that nothing ends up in the landfill.
That's the ultimate goal. When you manufacture a product, it gets recycled back into the production stream and then gets produced as another product. So it's an endless circle. What you produce comes around and gets recycled.
Is it to encourage a more thoughtful approach to manufacturing the product from the very beginning?
It is. It's an effort to eliminate waste and bring recycling content as feedstock back into your business and industry. And the key point of this is our landfills are filling up. And one of the items that really fills up our landfills are textiles. And that kind of leads us into our workshop that we had on April 9th in Goleta.
Yeah, tell us about that workshop. And first of all, textiles are defined as products like clothing and rugs and other materials like that.
Yes. And to just give you an idea about the problem, the average U.S. consumer throws away approximately 81.5 pounds of clothes annually. And in 2018, 17 million tons of textile waste ended up in the landfills. And in California, over 1 million tons of textiles were disposed in landfills. And here's another key. Textiles, when you talk about shirts, blankets, and those types of things, they can take up to 200 years to decompose. And the reason is the plastics that are interwoven into textiles.
That's interesting because if you think of something as being made of cotton, you would expect it to break down more easily.
You know, that's an interesting point because one of our speakers, Leslie Roberts, from Southern California Fiber Shed, had a presentation and actually showed a photograph of two shirts. One was a wool shirt, 100% wool. The other one was a shirt with polyester and rayon and those type of fibers into the shirt. And what they did is they took those two shirts and they buried them into the ground for 5 years. Then they took them out and the wool shirt was almost entirely decomposed. The other shirt, you could take it to the dry cleaners and they could clean it and you could wear it again. And that gives you an indication of how these plastic fibers affect decomposition for textiles.
Right. Wow. Talk about the workshop and your goals for bringing this to the community.
We partnered up with CPSC, which is the California Product Stewardship Council. And they are professionals when it comes to workshops, like textile workshops. So we were very glad to partner with them and provide the funding for this workshop. And what we did is we had standing room only. We had people interested in textiles. We had some great keynote speakers. We had waste haulers. We had some recyclers there. We had some brands there like Patagonia and Toad and Company, companies that are focused on recycling of textiles. And as I said, it was standing room only. It gave people an opportunity to talk about the textile problem, talk about recycling and ways to get involved.
Was this new information to a lot of the people who attended?
It was. A lot of folks that are in the industry know a lot of this information, but we had a lot of community members and a lot of facts came out, like I just mentioned about decomposing textiles and how, you know, when you add plastic fibers, how long it takes. So it was very interesting, very eye-opening. It talked about how textiles are put together, interesting ways to recycle textiles.
Can you give an example?
Yes, I'll give you a couple examples. One is older clothes that you can improve on and put a brand name on it and resell that article. Another example would be a company that takes old blankets and old clothes and can cut them up into rags that can then be used in industry. Contractors, when they do painting, they use millions of pounds of rags a year. And if you can find a way to take textiles that would go to the landfill, cut them up into rags and use those rags, that's an idea on an industry level, you know, how you can recycle textiles.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm talking with Dave Cross about a recent workshop in Goleta on finding more ways for recycling textiles.
It's difficult. And the reason is the cost of new clothes compared to the cost of recycling clothes is inexpensive. And so you have a cost disparity there where it's so much more expensive to recycle clothes and resell them than it is to go and buy a new shirt or a new pair of pants. And that kind of leads into one of our keynote speakers was Roland Geyer, professor of industrial ecology at UC Santa Barbara. At the Bren School of Environmental Science and Management. And he had an interesting take on that. He said that repair and recycling aren't prohibitively expensive. Rather, it's the undervaluing of these practices in favor of cheap new production. That's the real issue.
And the landfills are just growing and growing.
The landfills, as the RMDZ program zone administrator, there are a lot of factors in landfills. Textiles, a big part of it. Plastic is a big part of it. Food waste is a big part of it. Those are all independent discussions, but it's all part of the overall concept of recycling and reducing the waste into our landfills.
And so does Cal Recycle provide grants or assistance to get companies started on a new way of doing business?
That's a great question, because with the RMDZ program, there is a loan program involved. It's a low interest loan, and it can be used for operational costs. It can be used for equipment, for manufacturers to reduce that waste and to bring in more recycled content. And it can be used for startups. So there's a loan program. There's also grants that are available through CalRecycle for different parts of industry. It can be the food industry. It can be agriculture. It can be manufacturing.
What if someone has a really creative idea of turning plastic bottles into something we haven't even thought of yet? They can go get a loan, or?
The loan is available for an existing company or business, or if you're an upstart business, they can help you. You just have to have a sustainable business to be able to qualify for the loan. But it is available. And let me give you a couple of examples. A company that we assisted takes agricultural plastic that we see miles of as we drive through the Central Coast to recycle that into plastic pellets that can then be used downstream. Another example would be a company that takes old wine barrels and converts them into furniture instead of going to the landfill. A lot of creative ways that can be used. And so we're here to help. I can provide advice through our RMDZ program and provide some resources, some contacts, places they can go to assist them in bringing their idea into fruition.
How many people do you think attended the workshop?
We had over 100 community members at this workshop.
There's definitely interest.
There's a lot of creative people out there. There's a lot of ingenuity, and they could come up with something, as you said, that, you know, hasn't been on the market before. And so we want to help promote that. We want to tap into that ingenuity of, you know, the individual and bringing those to market and finding creative ways for recycling, you know, for these textiles. That is so key. Historically, we've been able to do that, and we want to be able to do that for this.
And the Central Coast is a good place for this, right? We're such an environmentally aware region, and we also have a lot of small businesses.
The awareness is here on the Central Coast. And one of our keynote speakers was Mia Lopez from the Washtoyo Chumash tribe. And she indicated how recycling is just part of the overall holistic approach to recycling and actually living, to recycling things in your life and things that you see. It's a perspective, and I think a lot of people have that on the Central Coast, and the awareness is rising for that type of approach to everything, a holistic approach to recycling, to manufacturing, to industry, to how we live.
Thank you so much, Dave, for this conversation. Dave Cross from Santa Maria Valley Chamber of Commerce and the RMDZ representative.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity. And just once again, I urge everyone to go to the CalRecycle website, and they can look at many programs that CalRecycle has available.
For Issues and Ideas, I'm Beth Thornton.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, Working Lunch.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jim D'Antona, CEO for the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and your host today. And this is the Working Lunch. The SLO Chamber has formed a direct partnership with KCBX to bring you these Working Lunch discussions. Each month, we will sit down and meet with a member of our community to talk about doing business on the Central Coast. We'll be bringing you conversation with folks who are doing interesting things and impacting the business community that will help them meet the challenge of our current business environment. We hope you'll join us for these conversations every month on KCBX's Issues and Ideas. Today, I'm so pleased to be sitting down with Jeff Seitel and Jeanette Garrett. Jeff is the Chief Executive Officer and founder of WSC. Jeanette is the WSC's Director of People and Culture. WSC is a company headquartered here in San Luis Obispo, but has offices throughout California and in Portland, Oregon. Hello, Jeff and Jeanette.
Hi, Jim.
Good to see you, Jim. Thanks for having us.
Well, WSC was formed over 15 years ago to help municipal organizations think holistically about how to distribute, manage, and conserve water. Jeff and his team of over 70 professionals work with water agencies, municipalities, and organizations to design water plans that will help create a sustainable water program now and well into the future. So Jeff, let's just start out with a little about you as the founder of WSC. I saw that you did your undergrad work at UC Davis in engineering and then went to UCLA for your master's. Let's start, where'd you grow up? Where'd you get your experience?
So I grew up in San Diego, North County, rural North County, San Diego. And it's an arid climate. Mm-hmm. So you really recognize the value of water. We'd vacation to the Colorado River. And the big dams and systems there were always very interesting to me. Like, why is there a lake in the middle of the desert? And I'm an analytical guy. I love science and math, and so engineering and water just for me go hand in hand.
So then, how'd you end up here in San Luis Obispo?
It's fun. My wife, who I met at UC Davis, grew up here on the Central Coast. So she dragged me down. She said, "You got to come check this place out," and I really fell in love with it.
It's interesting also having your wife go from San Luis to UC Davis. Had to get out of San Luis for a little while before coming back, I guess.
I think so. Well, my daughter actually is going to be going to UC Davis now too. So runs in the family.
That's so fun. So obviously water is a huge issue throughout the state of California. And I'm wondering if dealing with the size and scale of California's water issue actually puts your company in a unique position to work on other water management programs throughout the United States.
Yeah, the challenges and opportunities in California really aren't unique to California, but California is the fifth largest economy in the world, and we have diverse agriculture, business, cities, and towns. So things are happening in California at a very large scale. Plus, we have very large and well-developed water infrastructure and systems. We move water around the state from Northern California where it rains to Southern California where it doesn't, and then irrigate the Central Valley along the way. The Sierra Nevada is essentially our primary storage for water in the form of snowpack, but also in all of the reservoirs that have been built over the decades there in the foothills of the Sierra. So there's all of these things are happening in California, and so it's a wonderful place to practice civil and environmental engineering, especially related to water. So the things that we work on in California really can apply anywhere else in the arid West, anywhere else in the country or the world. Everywhere we need water. And we need water that's sustainable.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you're right about that. Some of that history that has been about building the infrastructure to controversially maybe at sometimes, right? Northern to Southern California. Maybe you could talk a little bit about your thoughts or process when you're planning for regional water issues on the Central Coast. I mean, because it wasn't but a few years ago here that we thought Lopez Lake might go dry, and then 2 years of deluge and it spilled over for consecutive years.
Yeah, no, I think it's, we were talking a little bit earlier about the Central Coast and how the Central Coast is this microcosm. Climate variability is something you mentioned, and that stresses local water resources and imported water. So if you're in San Luis Obispo, we depend on imported water from the Delta. We also rely on groundwater basins and surface water. All of those sources of water are impacted by climate variability. So I have to think about it from the context of the uncertainty of the future. And I always have to start projects with that in mind, because the projects that we engineer have to be valuable, right? These are generational investments, and they benefit the communities for decades, if not 30, 40, 50 years or more. Surface water, groundwater, we have overuse, we have contamination. These are issues that are all across the world, really. So that's no different here on the Central Coast. But I think a key opportunity on the Central Coast is recycled water. So currently, we spend our treasure in infrastructure to bring water to our homes and our businesses. We treat that water. We clean it. Well, before we do that, we store it in reservoirs or in the ground. We pump it out of those reservoirs to a treatment facility. We treat it to a very high quality standard. And then distribute it out through a vast network of pipes to businesses and homes. And we deliver that as drinkable water. We use it once through our homes and businesses, and then we send it to a wastewater treatment facility that then discharges it to the ocean. So the idea is that that's a resource, and it's a resource that we can use through recycling. The technology exists to treat that water to a very high quality standard and use it either for irrigation, for industrial uses, but most importantly, it can be used for drinking.
Great point. I love that you're talking about that, because that was we do this great work on it to treat it, and then we put it in the creek and then send it out to the ocean. It's like, wow. I mean, we have wonderful agriculture. We have all these things. And if we kind of just work together, we might find a way to use that water in a way, whether that's recharging the aquifers, using it for irrigation, figuring it out how to use it holistically. And right now we're still doing that, right? I mean, are you seeing great examples in other places where they're figuring that out?
Definitely. I'm glad you brought up City of San Luis Obispo. The upgrade to their water resource recovery facility is actually a project that WSC managed for the city. And the system is now operational, a significant upgrade to the treatment facility using membrane filtration, in addition to ultraviolet light for disinfection, which dramatically reduces the amount of chemicals that are needed through that treatment facility and significantly improves the water quality. Removing nitrates and removing disinfection byproducts that are formed the way they used to treat the water by adding chlorine. Another example I can think of recently here close to home is the Cayuca Sustainable Water Project. There's an example of a facility where unfortunately, the relationship between the Cayucas Sanitary District and the city of Morro Bay broke down. But Cayucas came to us and said, can we still go it alone? Can we still create a sustainable resource for our community? And we said, yeah, you can. And we helped them design and build and now start up and implement the Cayucas Sustainable Water Project with a brand new water resource recovery facility. Also uses membranes and ultraviolet light. The idea there is that water can be used for agricultural irrigation, but then potentially also put and stored in a reservoir that can be used for drinking water treatment at some point down the road. So these projects happen in steps, and it really requires a community to come together and understand the value of planning for these long-term needs. It's expensive, takes time, and it takes courageous leadership and follow-through. But when communities can come together, they can realize those benefits, and then they can build from there.
That's very exciting. And you hit it on the head with so many of those pieces. And you touched on a piece there, Central Coast Blue, a water supply project that would provide a sustainable water source for South Slo County. It had to be paused due to some municipal issues between the cities involved. Whether it was this year or sometime soon, is that a project that kind of must happen, and do you think will happen?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. I mean, one thing just to keep in mind, building water resilience in arid communities in the face of increased climate uncertainty is very challenging. And it can be very costly for communities to tackle, especially in smaller communities like we have on the Central Coast. Even with grants from the state and federal governments, these water resilience projects can lead to big increases in water rates. And that's hard to stomach. These projects are technically complex. They not only require long-term vision, but they need sustained community support and political commitment to be successful, especially as conditions change. And I think what those communities are going through are some changed conditions. Lopez Lake, as you mentioned, is now full. The groundwater basin is also very healthy right now, and there's water to be used there. So it's hard to see the value of water resilience investments when our reservoirs are full. And it's important for communities to have well-informed dialogue about how best to achieve water resilience for their communities. And that's really, I think, the moment that we're in here in the South County. I believe that collaborative development of recycled water is the most responsible and cost-effective long-term answer for the South County. But it will take time for the communities to turn that vision into a reality. And it's critical that the community and the elected officials focused on the best available science and engineering to help them navigate this very complex issue for the benefit of their communities. And it's my hope that the managers and elected officials in the South County take this moment to engage their communities, listen to what their communities' priorities are, and lean into sustainable collaborative solutions instead of kind of quickly turning away from a decade of really meaningful progress.
If you're just joining us, I'm Jim D'Antona from the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and this is Working Lunch on KCBX. And we are here with Jeff Seitel, Jeanette Garrett, talking about water planning of Slo County into the future. You talked about there, you know, obviously this is expensive to implement this infrastructure, but, I hope at some point we start talking about how expensive it's going to be if we need to import water from way out. And if you get ahead now, yes, a little extra investment now saves us long term. And I know it's hard, and especially, you know, working with municipalities all over the place, I know how hard it is to put this in. But the education of why this project is super important and the extra spending now and what that could save us in the long term would be incredibly valuable, I think. And, you know, as you're talking through all these incredible, like, how you're doing these projects, I think about it must take a significant human infrastructure on your side to not only build the projects, but able to provide the support to your project managers. I said at the beginning, you have over 70 employees. We all know how difficult it is to find and keep staff, and with the varied professionals you employ, do you find it difficult to keep the continuity of your team together?
I think that's at the core of everything we do. Our vision is to create a better water future, but really our work is driven by values, human values. And our values as a company are pretty simple. We listen to understand, we create value, we nurture trust, and we leave it better. So that's how we work as a company, and that requires committed, dedicated professionals that are well-trained, well-educated, and that want to create value for the communities that we serve. As we've grown, it's been an intentional focus to create an environment that supports our diverse workforce and empowers them to pursue their passions and be the best version of themselves every day when they're serving our clients. WSC is an employee-owned company. So since 2016, I've given 25% of the company's stock to the employees in the form of an employee stock ownership program. And as we grow, the value of that ESOP is also growing. So that's an exciting way for the employees to participate in what we're doing as a company. And I like to share the story. When I hired Jeanette in 2018, I remember one of our first conversations. I said, "Jeanette, your sole job at WSC is to take care of our people." From that day forward, she's just been a tireless champion of our people, really being creative and courageous to help us envision how to better take care of our staff and how to create an environment and a culture where they can thrive. I'd love for Jeanette to share a bit about her perspective on that.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. That's right. Jeff mentioned that we have an ESOP, and that's really just the beginning. We really keep the continuity and growth of our teams by intentionally, continually working hard to support our culture and providing benefits that our employees value.
Well, I love that your title is Director of People and Culture, right? Again, intentionality of what you're doing here. And you are one of the few Red Diamond award-winning family-friendly workplaces. That's the absolute highest we give. And that means you tackle actual childcare issues in your company. You know, what is it specifically that you do, and why did you decide to go to that level?
You know, we really strive to support our employees' well-being, including their physical, financial, mental health, and also helping them achieve their work-life harmony, which includes family-friendly workplace benefits. So we offered a new benefit, and it's called Vivi. It's a program that offers backup childcare, pet care, elder care, and tutoring. Several employees use this benefit on a pretty regular basis, and they love it. We actually had a marketing team retreat recently up in here in San Luis Obispo at our office, and people from all over the West Coast use their backup childcare so that they could travel for work.
Such an incredible investment in your employees. Again, keeping great people, doing great, like that human infrastructure is so important to all the work you're doing. Vivi sounds really interesting. We'll have to probably do a whole separate thing on on how to kind of work on that. So I always kind of like to end our discussion with a bit of forecasting about the future. Since you are in the water business and you are seeing the implications of the ever-changing climate, do you forecast just longer and more extreme weather patterns, or will this be these chaotic swings back and forth? No one obviously has that perfect crystal ball, but how are you advising your clients to think about it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we can't forecast the weather. We rely on Google for that. But in terms of what our clients and the communities where we work within are facing in the future, we spend a lot of time thinking about that. And we do ongoing and consistent research into modern climate science. And I can tell you that the science is very compelling, very well documented. We're facing a future of more frequent and more severe weather extremes compared to the recent history, and including longer, more intense droughts, and more severe flooding. And that is just part of it. Plus, we're facing a gradually warming climate, which leads to reduced snowpack, which directly affects our primary storage for fresh water in California and in the arid West, which is snowpack in the mountains. Plus, our coastal communities are dealing with the threat of sea level rise. What we're faced with is a lot of the infrastructure that's been built over decades and centuries in some cases is all subject to severe flooding, which can lead to contamination of drinking water supplies. So that's a whole nother consideration, is dealing with that combined effect of this variable climate. So at WSC, when we work on long-term water resilience, we try to model that uncertainty as best we can. And we use large data sets. We use statistical methods, machine learning, artificial intelligence. We try to, at the same time, evaluate a variety of environmental, social, and economic considerations. So it's called multi-criteria analysis. And perhaps most importantly, we look for ways to create adaptability and flexibility. We also encourage, you brought this up a little earlier, we also encourage communities to get together. I think communities have formed these silos over the years, which is great in a lot of ways, but really challenging when it comes to something as basic as water. So we encourage communities to get together, work collaboratively where their interests align. And not all communities have the same interests, but there oftentimes is a lot of overlap and alignment. So that's what we really focus on. It's really hard work. But when it's done right, it can be transformative for a community. I can give you some examples. On the Central Coast, we recently helped the city of Camarillo design and build a brackish groundwater desalination system to clean up their contaminated groundwater basin while providing a new source of drinking water. We mentioned the Slow Water Plus for the city of Salo, upgrading their water resource recovery facility. And we also mentioned Cayuca's Sustainable Water Project. So those are just a few examples of how we start from the bigger picture. We use the best available information and the best available science. We develop alternatives and evaluate those alternatives so that we can come up with solutions that are adaptive and can be flexible for the long term. Because again, these are generational investments. So this is the kind of work that gets us up in the morning. This is what we're fired up about. This is what we mean when we say creating a better water future.
It's so awesome to listen to, and so exciting, and so thankful that there are folks like you and your team doing this work to think about this for the general population, because it is so exciting. And obviously, somehow, we have not really done a great job of keeping this one resource that is so valuable to all of us in at the front of our mind. So I'm just so thankful that your team is here and you are doing this great work. If folks want to learn more about the projects, which I will tell you, I've been through your website. It's great if you want to learn about all of them, or how to get connected to WSC, what's the best way for them to do that?
Betterwaterfuture.com. So you can go right to our website with betterwaterfuture.com. You can also check us out on LinkedIn. We're also on Instagram. We like to post news stories. All of that information is available directly on our website. So I encourage you to check it out.
Yeah, I would definitely advise you to. It's got really exciting stuff, and you can read all about these different projects they're working on throughout the U.S. Well, thank you so much, Jeff and Jeanette, for joining us today and sharing some of your thoughts. To you, our listeners, thank you for joining us for this important conversation. On behalf of Jeff Seitel and Jeanette Garrett of WSC, KCBX, and I'm Jim D'Antona for the Slow Chamber of Commerce, we hope you have an amazing week. Keep making our community a wonderful place to live.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, KCBX's Brian Reynolds and author Doug Garland explore the tall poppy syndrome.
Hello, I'm Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we're joined by a retired orthopedic surgeon and author, Doug Garland, and we're going to be talking about his book and his blog. The book is entitled The Tall Poppy Syndrome, The Joy of Cutting Others Down. Welcome, Doug.
It's my pleasure, Brian.
Tell me a little bit about yourself, where you came from, and how you came to write this book, please.
I grew up on a small farm town in Iowa. I eventually became a physician. I served in the military in Vietnam in a MASH unit on the DMC. And I eventually ended up in L.A. area. I practiced private orthopedics there for 37 years. I was a clinical professor of orthopedics at USC. I worked 30 years at Rancho Los Amigos Rehabilitation Center, which is a county facility. Most of the time there, I volunteered. I was head of their spinal cord injury unit, which is one of the largest centers in the country and world. And I was also president of the American Spinal Injury Association. At that particular time in my life, I was setting up to do a sabbatical in Australia. They have 6 rehabilitation centers in the country. I had come back from an international meeting on spinal cord injuries, and my Supreme office, which is the corner office with the window, had been transferred down to the cubbyhole in this facility. I didn't understand. When I told my wife what had happened, she told me I had had my cheese moved, which was a popular book at that time. She told me that my time was past at the facility, times had changed, and that I needed to move on. The next morning, I went into my office. I threw away all my slides, all my talks, all my science reports, all my posters on the wall, put the key on the desk, and walked out. I called Australia and told them I wasn't coming. They wanted to know why. I told them, I explained what happened, and they said, "You've been tall poppied." That phrase was very unusual to me, and after about 3 explanations, it finally settled in. I was fortunate enough to have a wife with emotional intelligence to tell me to move on and not become emotionally involved, especially the bad emotion of bad envy and or anger, and seek revenge and try and find out who had cut me down. So I spent the next 10 years finishing my private practice. When I retired, I decided to study the tall poppy syndrome and eventually wrote a book about it. The metaphor is to look at a poppy field and seeing a few poppies taller than the rest. And the natural tendency for all societies are to cut that person or those tall poppies down so that everybody's equal.
A veteran, a doctor at the top of his game, and a technical writer, which I admire so much. It's a very difficult genre to do. There's a connection, a kind of a triangular connection we're going to make. One relates to Australia. Another would be ancient history. Or two, the other two, ancient history, one related to ancient Greece, and then the Bible itself, all having to do with tall poppies and having them cut down. Could you expand on that a little bit, please?
So the Bible, within Genesis, the first couple chapters, we have Cain and Abel, they're brothers, and with familial envy, one of the biggest cutters in the tall poppy syndrome, we have Cain killing Abel because of jealousy or envy, not jealousy. Also in the Bible is Adam and Eve. Eve is very prideful and wants to be equal to God. She's envious of God, and she also is cut down. So we have 2 examples early in the Bible of the tall poppy syndrome. One was envy, and the other was pride. And those are the 2 main drivers of the tall poppy syndrome. In ancient Greece, they described the tall poppy syndrome. Aristotle described it. He used ears of corn instead of poppies. Later, Roman historian Livy also described the tall poppy syndrome. And Livy used the poppies themselves of lopping off heads, describing the tall poppy syndrome but not naming it. Now, in the English-speaking world, the tall poppy syndrome is most prevalent in Australia. It's a national pastime in that country. And we think the reason it's so prevalent there is it's the most envious country in the world, according to polls. That country is very egalitarianistic. It was set up as a penal colony for England. And, of course, if you're in a jail, everybody is equal. And so if somebody has a toothbrush that nobody else has, that person is liable to have that toothbrush destroyed. So the culture of Australia evolved from that communal concept of the prison.
If we think in sort of pictorial terms, and there's a picture on the cover of your book, scissors and a beautiful red poppy, and the scissors are in the act of being cutting that poppy. But if we imagine humanity as a field of poppies, there's always a few that will be stronger, taller, maybe more beautiful than others. And I think that's just natural with the world that we live in, not only humans, but creatures large and small. But the attitude of others towards high achievers depends on a positive a feeling of envy, or perhaps a good envy, if you want to call it that, and also a negative envy. Could you give us an example of each, a good and a bad type of envy?
Well, the emotions are really a functional state, and many people classify them in various ways. I look at them as positive and negative, or good and bad, as you've mentioned. So good envy, and envy is the most common emotion. It's always on. It's a comparison emotion, which is how I got into medical school. I came from a very basic background. My town was only 400 people. There were 15 kids in my as classmates, and I had very little education, so to speak. But I learned early to envy the tall poppies or the smart kids in all my classes, whether it became high school, college, or medical school, and advanced my career. So that's an example of good envy, is seeing a tall poppy and envying that poppy and trying to improve yourself. Bad envy is you're envious and lazy. Most cutters have low self-esteem. So they feel they will never be a tall poppy. So in order to compete with the tall poppy, they want to cut that tall poppy down instead of helping themselves improve and make a better life. And of course, all you have to do is think of politicians who are the worst cutters in the world.
I'd like to remind everyone that I am Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by retired orthopedic surgeon and author Doug Garland, discussing his book, The Tall Poppy Syndrome, The Joy of Cutting Others Down, and also his blog, tallpoppy.org. There are reasons that, Doug, that people are tall poppies. They excel in some fashion. They could be smarter, but they also could be more devious, or more cunning instead of, let's say, wise. Isn't it true that people get cut down pretty much in the same fashion? What they're taller than others for something admirable or for something not admirable?
Well, Steve Jobs changed the world with his iPhone, but Steve was a bit of a sociopath, and he cut a lot of people down early in his career, and then what goes around comes around, or you live by the sword, die by the sword. He eventually was cut down himself. The board cut him down for some bad behavior of his. And it wasn't until he matured as an adult, founded two other companies, and came back to relead Apple that he became the true tall poppy that he deserved. So I break the tall poppy into two groups. Peer-to-peer, which is your own tribe, and the most common occurrence of the tall poppy syndrome is within your own tribe, and it doesn't involve being tall. It's the emotions that are involved in the true tall poppy syndrome, which I label public, that you have a tall poppy and cut down by somebody who doesn't have as much power. But in your own tribe, the same emotional behavior occurs, and you cut people down even though they're not tall. The main emotional components of the cutter are envy, anger, and laziness. Now, the tall poppy who deserves to be a tall poppy, sometimes that goes to their head. And their emotional makeup for the public to feel they deserve, which is a key component, deservingness, the public feels they deserve to be cut down. It's pride, by far and away the most common negative emotion, followed by greed and lust. So when you look at the tall poppy syndrome, there's a cutter, somebody cutting down, and there's the tall poppy. The behavior can be bad on one side or the other, and as you evaluate that situation, you have to decide in your own mind, who is using good emotion and who is using bad emotion.
You and I have had discussions on more than one occasion about politics, which I view as a spiritual world, a word. It's not a negative word. It's only good or bad depending on how political a person is, and being political is informing yourself about the issues of the day, being engaged in the process like voting or writing letters or attending meetings, and not being discouraged. It doesn't matter whether it's partisan, right-wing, left-wing, but just to be political is a good thing. But in our country, more and more, and I didn't make this up, but there's a term called blemish politics. With a candidate, political candidate, we don't think about so much their positions on issues, but did they have something dark in their past and that could be unearthed and can it undo their political ambitions? Do you see the tall poppy syndrome at work, especially now in this political season leading up to an election in November?
Well, if you mention Trump, you automatically trigger that concept that you're describing. And if we look at Trump specifically in his court right now, it's all about finding a negative experience in the candidate and you then leveraging that negative experience to cut him down. So that's why I say politics, if you want to look for examples and study people, use politics. It's very, very discouraging to me, more so than when Brian and I have our talks, because it makes me sick. We lose the what should be aspirational, somebody like the Kennedys and leading the country and uniting the country. And now we're using the tall poppy syndrome to cut all our leaders down, and it becomes one big negative experience.
Sort of a bloodbath instead of a celebratory event.
Well, Bill Clinton bragged about that. He claims it's a blood sport. And I think that's totally wrong. That is the wrong way to look at politics, which should be one of the highest aspirations, just as it should be a high aspiration to be a tall poppy. The country moves ahead by tall poppies. Our robber barons in the 1880s have all been cut down, and in some instances deservedly so. But the country moved forward, and 1880s onward, America changed and became a world power and lifted our middle class up to the highest of any country that it's ever been. So they've done us a lot of favors, and we should condemn them for their bad features, bad emotions, but we should also not necessarily worship them, but emulate them.
You mentioned in your latest post on the blog the concept of a stone poppy. Could you tell us what that is?
Well, I have a glossary that when you look at my book, I have these terms that I make up. And rather, since nobody knows them, I thought it was better to put it in your face right away instead of looking to the back of the book so you know where to find them. And the stone poppy is somebody that can't be cut down. They're so tall and so strong that in spite of all people coming at them, they can't be cut down. So that's one of my terms. And a runt poppy, I call somebody that didn't deserve to be a poppy who was a tall poppy and eventually got cut down and is the runt they deserve to be.
That's so funny. You know, in my own background, there's, I think, a classic example. Andrew Carnegie was a robber baron of sorts, was pretty ruthless with unions and his steel business. At the same time, though, he was very interested in the literacy of his employees, having them read and write. And you could argue, well, that's to avoid industrial accidents and so forth. But he also, with his fortunes, established over 1,000 public libraries nationwide, including one here in the county. So I would call him a stone poppy.
I agree with you. I spent my entire medical career in the library, and I did a year of research on the tall poppy syndrome in a library, even though at that time the libraries were, especially the medical libraries, were virtual, because you have to pay for the journal, subscribe to it in order to read it. But a medical library pays for all those various journals. So you can either get their ID number and explore the world literature on a subject, which is what I did. But I still went into the library to do it because that was my habit. That was my study place. When I walked walked into the library, I was at home, and I was intellectually at home. So I couldn't love him more than anybody because I love libraries.
Well, that gives me warm and fuzzy feeling. As we wind up, I do want to touch on a topic which almost could be the subject of a subsequent discussion, and that is the internet, which is so important and so ubiquitous, so addictive in so many ways. I mean, I'm an addict and certain things I look up constantly, but it seems to me that it's very heavily used as a platform by anonymous haters, H-A-T-E-R-S. Keyboard warriors is another term I've heard. Anonymous people attacking people and causes they don't like. It seems to me that on the bad envy side, the internet and the way we get information plays a big role. What do you think?
Well, I call envy one of the worst things that's happened to us. It's also one of the best things that's happened to us. But the iPhones, there's plenty of studies now showing that they're part of the reason our adolescents are having so much trouble. There's two parts to this. One, this is driven by bad envy and the selfies of people going to dinner or going out to a movie and taking a selfie and send it to all their friends. And they're essentially saying, look at me. And the low self-esteem person looks at that and they become depressed. So it's this bad envy that is driving the young purveyors of the internet. Now, the other part that you're describing is anger, and it's the hidden cloak that the internet lets you have. And you can be angry and seek revenge and have tools at your disposal to take somebody down that you wouldn't have on a front person-to-person confrontation. So there's a lot of negative energy in the internet, and the understanding the tall poppy syndrome helps you move through the internet and know what to delete and block and what to emulate and enjoy.
Fascinating. I am Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by retired orthopedic surgeon and author Doug Garland, author of The Tall Poppy Syndrome, The Joy of Cutting Others Down, and also the moderator of the tallpoppysyndrome.org blog. Thank you so much, Doug.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's finish up with a look at a local sports team opening the door for LGBTQ+ youth.
When parents consider which after-school program to enroll their kids in, barreling down a roller rink at 25 miles an hour might not seem like a natural fit. But the nearly dozen kids ages 5 to 17, along with their coaches and parents on the San Luis Obispo County Junior Roller Derby Team, or SLOCO JRD, might disagree. Those are the skates of Flaming Mochi, Raging River of Death, Princess Leia, and their teammates on the SLOCO JRD. You won't hear typical names in this story. In roller derby, everyone picks their own names. The only rule? They have to love them. From weekly practices to community skates to regional competitions or bouts in roller derby slang, SLOCO JRD has been fostering a love for skating among youth and families on the Central Coast in a fun and empowering way. Part of creating that empowering environment is the team's intentional commitment to being inclusive to youth of all genders, sexualities, and walks of life.
Outside of the track, on the track, they are fully accepted for who they are, what they're going through. We try to give them the space to explore themselves in a very safe, protective community.
That's Killith, a derby name mashup between the mythological goddess Lilith and a personal love of murder mysteries. Killith is a SLOCO JRD coach.
The roller derby community is incredibly accepting of every individual, no matter where they are in their journey as a person. It's a very inclusive, hate-free community.
On the Central Coast, creating safe spaces for LGBTQ youth can be life-saving. According to the California Healthy Kids Survey, between 2019 and 2021, more than 60% of transgender students in San Luis Obispo County considered attempting suicide, compared to just 17% of their cisgender peers. In that same survey, nearly 26% of local transgender youth said they don't think there are any adults in their life who care about them. In a time when so many local LGBTQ youth feel unwanted and misunderstood by their communities, SLOCO JRD creates a loving environment for kids to be themselves, one that starts with the coaches and is reinforced by parents like Candace Hubbard, SLOCO JRD board president and parent to one of the skaters.
I know that we have had skaters that this is their safe zone, that this is where they're thriving in their current life, and they need this space.
Skaters like Death Valerie, Hubbard's daughter and SLOCO JRD junior captain, say inclusivity is part of what makes SLOCO JRD so special.
I think it's really cool being on an inclusive team because there's different genders, there's different pronouns, there's different everything. So it's just like you get to learn a bunch of stuff about people and you get to meet new people and it's really fun.
When asked why they love roller derby, every skater at the SLOCO JRD practice talked about their confidence and the friends and community they've been able to make. While there's a lot of crossover with the LGBTQ community, Hubbard says SLOCO JRD exists to make skating accessible to all youth, which also means offering financial help to skaters who need it.
We firmly believe that everyone should be able to participate in roller derby if they want to. They won't be turned away because they can't afford the registration fee, or won't be turned away because they don't have skates. We will get them skates.
Community members can learn more about SLOCO JRD by visiting their website, slocojuniorrollerderby.org, or by attending the team's skateathon and open skate April 14th at Santa Rosa Park. Hubbard and coaches say they want to see everyone come out to the community skate to learn what roller derby is all about and see skaters do what they love.
SLOCO! 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 Feel the burn! Feel the wombat!
For KCBX News, I'm Janae Sargent.
Been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. Jacqueline Martin assisted with editing. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.